What does it mean, David, to have a living connection to nature, to the universe? What does that connection mean?
Well, I think that when you have a living connection, you feel that you're part of a larger reality that goes beyond beyond yourself. And that's the normal state of what it really means to be a human being. And over the past few centuries, it seems that in some ways, we've lost that in a cultural sense.
Now, the book we're talking about today is called Restoring the Soul of the World, Our Living Bond with Nature's Intelligence. Now, when you speak about soul, and you've written in the book that the world has a soul, the entire cosmos has a soul, define soul for us.
The idea of the world's soul, and actually the idea of soul in general, goes back to the ancient Greeks, and the word psyche comes from the Greek word psuche. It's the same word. And what psuche means is life, to be alive. And the way that the Greek philosophers looked at the world is that the world itself is continually in motion, which is a form of a living activity. And the other aspect of it is that nature is continuously engaged in pattern-making activities. And when you create patterns and forms, that implies that there's some kind of strategy involved. And so the idea of soul and the world soul points to this idea that there's an active power in nature that's a form of intelligence. And we can see that in living organisms, for example. Basically, there was an ancient Greek philosopher that said that anything that is alive is intelligent. And we can see that, for example, like when we cut our hand, the hand knows how to heal itself. And if you cut off the head of a flatworm, it knows how to grow another head. And you can see this type of intelligence displayed, you know, throughout living things, as well as other types of organisms in the natural world.
Elaborate, David, for us how the Greeks saw nature, your expertise is in philosophy, and how we came from how they saw nature to how we see it today with our more mechanistic worldview.
Okay. Well, the Greeks saw nature as a unified phenomenon, really as a unified organism. And a lot of the Greek thought was, it really was summed up by Plato and Plato's idea of the world soul. And Plato said that the universe is a single living organism that contains all organisms within it. So basically, everything is interconnected and organically connected. This was pretty much the normative worldview for hundreds of years in the Western world, and sometimes it would fade in and out a little bit. But basically, it was the normative worldview for hundreds of years, and it was only with the emergence of the mechanistic worldview in the time of the scientific revolution that changed. And the French philosopher René Descartes summed that up very well when he said that I have described this earth and indeed this whole visible world as a machine. So you can see how his perspective is quite different from Plato's perspective, where Plato said that the universe was a single living creature that contained all living creatures within it.
And there's also Christian theology that gets kind of ambiguous in terms of home. In Christian theology, we have home being elsewhere, not here on earth. Talk about that influence on how that's changed our connection or disconnection in some cases to nature.
The Christian view about the world soul was somewhat ambiguous. And there were some early Christian writers who embraced the idea, and they identified the idea of living nature and the world, well, the world soul, with the Holy Spirit. But there were other Christian thinkers that felt that the idea of the world soul gave nature too much power, and that it was a potentially dangerous idea because if nature had that kind of intelligence, it could potentially create itself. And one of the key figures that I mentioned in the book was the early Christian writer Lactantius, who said really that the world was not our home, but it was a constructed artifact, and that it's just sort of like a stopping place on the way to our real home, which is the afterlife. So we don't really belong here. It's just sort of like a hotel in a sense.
Right.
And this idea that the world was actually constructed is sort of a forebearer of the idea of the mechanistic worldview, because the ancient Greek view was that there is an intelligence that is inherent in nature, and that there is a design to the cosmos. If there was no design to the cosmos, it wouldn't be a cosmos. But that design comes from the cosmos itself. It's not imposed upon it from some outside source. It's from nature's own intelligence. And so this idea that the world was constructed, or that it was constructed by God in the sense that God is something external to the world, and sort of like a human intelligence that drew up a blueprint, that's a totally alien view to like ancient Greek thought.
And you've said that there's two sides to everything, including technology, the good and the bad, and perhaps then that would go hand in hand with the mechanistic worldview. Can you talk about that, and how do we find balance between those two sides?
You know, technology is wonderful if it's a tool that you use, but it becomes something negative, I suppose, if you become an instrument of the technology. So that is one of the negative aspects of the mechanistic worldview, in that, for example, it gave rise to the myth of progress and the Industrial Revolution. And there was a, reductionistic, impulse, or a reductionistic view that arose, both about the external world and also the world of human beings. And so you're familiar with the idea of, like workers in factories becoming like replaceable cogs. And that was illustrated very well in, Charlie Chaplin's film, Modern Times. Mm. So that is an example of human beings becoming essentially extensions of the technology, rather than technology being tools that we're consciously using.
And beauty. You've talked about beauty as well. Nature is filled with it. Talk about the need or the purpose of beauty, because there is a need and a purpose. I think when people get too far in one direction, isolated in, say, Cube City, in the office, and in their buildings, in their cities, and they don't get out to nature, some of that beauty is missing. I've felt that myself, that if I don't get out there often enough, something is missing. So what is the purpose of beauty in nature?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've undoubtedly heard the famous idea that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. And The Greeks looked at it in an entirely different way, and they really saw beauty as being an objective quality of the natural world, which is something that I believe. I believe that taste is subjective and in the eye of the beholder and cultural to some degree. But I believe that beauty itself is a characteristic of nature, and that's why Pythagoras, the Greek philosopher, called the universe a cosmos. Which means a beautiful order, because when you look at the order of nature, you see this radiant beauty and all of these proportional relationships in which things are based. And if you look at more recent philosophers, like Goethe or Gregory Bateson, they both express this idea that nature's beauty reveals to us something about the deep structure of the world and our relationship to it that would otherwise remain hidden. And that's why I think beauty is so important, because when we are able to sense the beauty in nature, we're able to intuitively sense our own connection with this greater order of which we're a part. And if we lose that sense of beauty, we also lose a way of understanding our own deeper connection with the living world.
I wonder if it's in part those patterns, that symmetry that we see in nature that translates into our understanding of beauty. I believe I've read a study somewhere that the faces, that human faces that we're attracted to, as you said, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and yet what we all seem to be attracted to is symmetry. And symmetry goes hand in hand with patterns. So I wonder if that's part of it, that there's something in us that likes that order, that pattern when we look out at the world.
Yes, and there's some kind of natural tendency or power within living things and the living structures of the cosmos to unfold in harmonically, structured ways. And the reason that that happens is that if you look at living structures, living organisms, they use proportion as a strategy of integrating the part with the whole. And so, for example, that's why your hand has the proportions that it does, so that it can close around something and unfold. And the proportions of your finger bones or phalanges are an exact mathematical ratio that allows that to happen in the most elegant way. And in the same way, plants have learned how to position their leaves so that each branch is at that exact angle that allows the leaves to receive the most energy from the sun. And so there's actually a reason that we see this elegant beauty in nature, because it's also something that allows things to function in the most elegant way.
So function is beautiful.
Yes, it is in nature, it is in the natural world, but then people have misused that idea as well in terms of like utilitarianism in architecture, where they've actually, ironically, they've used that idea to destroy the idea of beauty as well. So like everything has two sides, so.
When you talk about patterns and all of that, in fact, your book starts with the sentence, "Everything begins with starlight." And one of your great interests is astronomy. You've written about how you travel with your telescope, and you did that when you were, although you're in Bosnia now, you grew up in Grand Rapids, correct?
That's correct, yes.
And this is where you discovered the stars. Can you talk about that? How you grew up in Grand Rapids and what astronomy is to you?
It's interesting because ever since I was very young, I was always very interested, by the stars. And then as I had a very serious interest. And then as I grew older, I had an interest in science, and that developed into an interest in philosophy. And then, of course, as I started to study the Greek philosophers, I learned that, Socrates said that all philosophy begins in wonder. And you have this idea in Plato as well, that it's actually from the stars that we learn mathematics and science and philosophy, because we see the patterns of the celestial objects, and they're sort of like beating out different rhythms and patterns that teach us number. And so that's how mathematics arises. And as I grew older, I still maintained my interest in astronomy. And then when I was in my early 30s, I actually built an astronomical observatory outside of Grand Rapids at the farm I used to have. And before that, I used to go up north to Glen Arbor and take this really wonderful telescope that I had. So I use that as an example of how, in one way, technology can take us away from the natural world, but it can also allow us to appreciate and understand the natural world in a much deeper way, because everything that we know about the universe, all the significant knowledge that we have, really originated over the last 150 years. And it's an amazing experience to be able to look through a telescope at some, galaxy or globular cluster that's literally millions and millions, or even tens of millions of light years away, and know what you're looking at. That's an experience that no earlier generation ever had access to.
Well, and you've also talked about how important it is for us to see ourselves as part of a larger whole. And probably looking at stars is the best way to get that sense that we're part of something that's much bigger than ourselves.
Historically, and you can find people today, if you discuss it with them, they find this idea terrifying that we live in such a large universe. But in my experience, knowing the story behind it and the fact that we live in a universe that is evolutionary and that even, matter has a history and that we're an outgrowth of this, entire, cosmic pattern, which becomes more complex over time. It makes me feel like I'm part of a larger reality because it's something that, we've all emerged from, as well as all of the other living systems in which we're embedded.
So, how do ethics grow out of belonging to something larger than yourself?
I think that there's a intrinsic relationship between ethics and the sense of belonging to something that's larger than yourself, because if we were just isolated individuals who had no connection to anyone else, there would be no reason to be ethical at all. We could be as self-centered as we want. But there's this ancient idea that goes back to the Greek philosophers that the world in which we live is really a community. And the reason that we're in this community is because there's a sort of a common intelligence that unites things together. And in terms of human beings, that's the rationality that we all share, as well as the other aspects of our makeup. And it's because of that that there is a human community, and because of that spark of rationality, that's why we have this impulse, to be rational beings, because we depend upon this community for our existence, and the community depends upon us. So when you look at it from that perspective, I think you can see that, the idea of acting in an ethical way, it's not just some kind of artificial human construction, but it's actually rooted in, a much deeper, structure of living things themselves.
So is nature ethical? Patterns embody goodness?
One of the things that happened with the scientific revolution is that we ended up in this double truth universe where you have the world of facts on one hand and you have the world of values on the other hand. And so a lot of scientists try and keep those two realms entirely separate. But if you look at the forms in nature, they do actually reflect values. And the ancient Greeks had this idea of virtue, or arete, which means something that possesses virtue works in the best possible way. So if you have like a good hammer, it's good for hammering nails. And if you have a structure in an organism, if you study the way that organisms work, they're actually designed, or over great periods of time, they've learned how to embody excellence in their structure. And so living organisms work in good ways. They embody that value of goodness, and that also gives rise to beauty. So that's a different way of looking at the natural world. And I think that that is, actually the most accurate way of looking at things. So this idea of the double truth universe, where you just have a world of facts and values that are totally disconnected from each other, I think that that's false.
So, if we go from that, can you say that chaos is evil, or is chaos just simply the birthing process of goodness?
No, I don't think chaos is evil. If you have too much order and the order is of a static nature, what will happen is you'll have a living system that will just freeze up. If you have that, then you're talking about a mechanical order. And if you look at the living systems in nature, all life exists within the boundary between chaos and order. And if you have too much chaos, the system will fall apart or fly apart. It can't hold together. But if you have too much order, it also destroys the system. So you have to find a balance between openness and structure.
Balance always seemed to be the key. So
Yes.
I
Yes.
think, anything in the creative process, there always has to be just a little bit of chaos.
Well, this was actually the failure of the mechanistic worldview, because the mechanistic worldview pictured the universe as being a totally deterministic machine. And there was a French philosopher or scientist, I can't remember his name right off, it's in my book, but might come back to me. But basically, he took this Newtonian idea that the universe was a machine, and he said that if you knew the exact mass and velocity of every particle in the universe, and you had basically a powerful enough supercomputer, you would be able to predict the future state of the universe, you know, if you had that kind of computing power. And what that would mean is that we live in a totally deterministic universe that's not open at all. There's no freedom or anything like that. And since then, basically all of the underlying premises of the mechanistic worldview have been undermined by subsequent scientific discoveries. And I spend quite a bit of, you know, time in the book actually showing how all of these different premises were undermined by, you know, later scientific discoveries. And what we now know is that you know, there obviously is structure in the universe, and it is deterministic to some extent, but there's also openness. And scientists who study you know, complex self-organizing systems and, you know, things like that, basically now realize that the future of life and the future of the universe is open. It's not deterministic. You can't predict it in advance. And without that openness, the world would just, you know, be functioning as a machine.
Now, in Western civilization, I think we've built on the idea that nature is something that we need to control and master. And, you know, whether it's taking care of your lawn and getting those weeds out of there, or, you know, or on a much larger scale, is that the point where we started going in the wrong direction? You're proposing something very different in your book. You talk about where we should be gardeners instead. Can you explain
yes.
that?
Well, with the scientific revolution and the emergence of the mechanistic worldview, there was also the emergence of this idea that nature should become the slave of mankind. It's a really strange idea, but that was a phrase used by Francis Bacon, who was an early philosopher of science. And so this is part of the mythology of progress that emerged at that time, which was a really unique idea that hadn't existed before in Western history. And the idea was that we could master nature, and basically through technology, we could tame nature and create a technological utopia or paradise on Earth. So what happened is that ancient Christian idea of sort of like the end of time became historicized, and became a historical myth rather than something spiritual, I suppose. But there have been these other traditions within the Western world that the function of human beings is actually to bring the world to fruition. And this was a view in the Renaissance that the world itself was like a vast garden, and that we were basically gardeners, and that the purpose of human life was to enhance the quality of all living things and to bring it to fruition. So this idea is basically collaborating with nature. And in the conclusion of the book, I make a case for this idea of not only learning from nature's intelligence, but collaborating with nature as well, so that we can undo some of the you know, vast ecological damage that has taken place because of the, you know, types of approaches that we've, you know, taken to the natural world and sort of the unconscious way that we've, you know, related to nature over the last century or 150 years, I suppose.
Yeah, you've called it violence against nature, and I think that's very fair to say. So is climate change one of those results that we see from our misinterpretation of what should be a partnership with nature rather than master and slave? Is climate change that result of our separation from nature?
I think that I don't really discuss climate change in the book so much, but I do talk about other things that we can really measure in the world in terms of our ecological footprint and things like that. And personally, I do believe in climate change, and I know people like to debate it and things like that. But the statistic that I really like to look at is something that actually came out after the book was published. It came out a few months ago. And it turns out that over the past 40 years, that human population on the Earth has doubled. And during that same 40-year period, half of all living animals in the wild have disappeared. So that is just an amazing figure, you know, when you consider that half of the living animals on the planet have disappeared in the past 40 years. So that's the statistic I really like to come back to, because people can debate climate change until they're blue in the face. But when you realize that 40% of all of the animals have disappeared, you know, that's a really strong message that the natural world is sending to us that we really need to hear.
And that's going beyond the normal cycles that we see in nature.
Because basically it all has to do with you know, the human effects on the environment by you know, changing natural habitats and, you know, dividing up, you know, land and things like that. So we've destroyed so many natural habitats. Climate change is part of it. So there are a lot of reasons why this has happened, but, you know, it's very well documented. There's a Global Footprint publication that comes out every year from the World Wildlife Foundation, I think, and they document this each year. So it's a pretty startling statistic.
Startling and upsetting.
Yeah.
So, talk to us about Cosmopolis Project.
Well, the Cosmopolis Project is basically a website that I have, and this idea of the Cosmopolis, it's a Greek word meaning world community. And I gave a talk a few years ago in Alexandria, Egypt, about this. And this was a very important idea to the Stoic philosophers in Hellenistic times. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that you know, all living beings are part of a single community. And it's because of the fact that we belong to a world community that we're called to be, you know, ethical beings. So I have a website called cosmopolisproject.org. And you know, it publishes various articles, you know, relating to some of the themes in the book. And we're actually holding a little conference as well on the humanities and the future of education and things like that. So it's an effort, you know, it's a small effort to make a contribution to this idea and question of what does it mean to actually live in a world community now, as opposed to just a global civilization. So, what is the difference between a global civilization and the sense of being part of a world community?
So, with that, let's sum this up. We're talking about your book, Restoring the Soul of the World, Our Living Bond with Nature's Intelligence. What is that main core message that you want your readers to come away with? What does this new and better worldview look like? How do we get there? And will we, do you come away with a sense of hope?
Well, you know, it depends on what day you ask me.
I hear you.
So actually, I'm feeling in a very good mood today, so maybe I do feel a little hopeful today. But there are many times when I feel hopeless as well. And I think that's fine. I think feeling hopeless is good. There's nothing wrong with that. But I feel that even if, you know, because when you look at these statistics, I mean, half of all the wildlife disappearing in the last 40 years, I mean, if we follow this trajectory, I mean, we're facing global catastrophe. I mean, they're predicting that they're going to run out of, they will have exploited all of the water supplies in China in 15 years. You know, that's a Chinese government.
Well, I've read somewhere that California is 1 year away
One
from
year
drought.
away. Exactly. And so, you know, we're facing potentially catastrophic situations. So, but even if the situation is hopeless, I feel that we have a responsibility. You know, each one of us has a responsibility to do what we can so that at least, you know, we made a noble effort to make the world a better place. And you asked that I end with a quotation from the book, and actually, this relates to it, I think, in a sense, because, the basic idea behind the book is that we had this idea of living nature in the past, and then it went into eclipse with the mechanistic worldview, and now it's coming back again in different ways, and it's supported by new scientific discoveries. And so the paragraph that I'm going to read is what some of the characteristics are of the worldview that's emerging right now. So I think that's maybe a good way to end it. And it goes like this. In the new worldview's scientific dimensions, the world is not static, but evolutionary. Life and the universe are not strictly deterministic, but embody an interplay between structure and openness. Like an ecosystem, the cosmos as a whole is not made up of isolated atomistic bits, but patterns of interdependent entities bound together in mutual relationships. Rather than consisting of pure spirit and dead matter, the world is a multi-leveled, creative, and self-organizing. Rather than picturing the universe as a machine, we can now see it as being a community. What the outcome of this shift will be is hard to predict, but science, worldview, and culture are intimately related. As our visions of nature, life, and the universe change, so too will the ways that we relate to the world and to other people.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, David. This has been very enjoyable.
Great. Well, it's been wonderful speaking with you.